In memory of L.I. Chigaev. Leonid Ivanovich Chigaev is dead. Dot, 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 dot. The suspension dots, customary in Russian obituaries, must represent the footprints of words that have departed on tiptoe, in reverent single file, leaving their tracks on the marble. Dot, 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 dot. However, I would like to violate this sepulchral silence. Please allow me to, dot, 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 just a few fragmentary, chaotic, basically uncalled for, dot, 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 but no matter. He and I met about 11 years ago, in a year that for me was disastrous. I was virtually perishing. Picture to yourself a young, still very young, helpless and lonely person, with a perpetually inflamed soul. It feared the least contact. It was like raw flesh, and unable to cope with the pangs of an unhappy love affair. Dot, 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 dot. I shall take the liberty of dwelling on this point for a moment. There was nothing exceptional about that thin, bob-haired German girl, but when I used to look at her suntanned cheek, at her rich, fair hair whose shiny golden yellow and olive gold strands sloped so roundly in profile from crown to nape, I felt like howling with tenderness. A tenderness that just would not fit inside me simply and comfortably, but remained wedged in the door, and would not bulge in or out, bulky, brittle cornered, and of no use to anyone, least of all to that lass. In short, I discovered that once a week, at her house, she betrayed me with a respectable paterfamilias, who incidentally was so infernally meticulous that he would bring his own shoe trees with him. It all ended with the circus-like whomp of a monstrous box on the ear, with which I knocked down the traitress, who rolled up in a ball where she had collapsed, her eyes glistening at me through her spread fingers. All in all, quite flattered, I think. Automatically, I searched for something to throw at her, saw the china sugar bowl I had given her for Easter, took the thing under my arm and went out, slamming the door. A footnote. This is but one of the conceivable versions of my parting with her. I had considered many of these impossible possibilities while still in the first heat of my drunken delirium, imagining now the gross gratification of a good slap, now the firing of an old parabellum pistol at her and at myself, at her and at the paterfamilias, only at her, only at myself, then, finally, a glacial irony, noble sadness, silence. Oh, things can go in so many ways, and I have long since forgotten how they actually went. My landlord at the time, an athletic Berliner, suffered permanently from furunculosis. The back of his neck showed a square of disgustingly pink sticking plaster with three neat apertures, for ventilation, maybe, or for the release of the pus. I worked in an émigré publishing house for a couple of languid-looking individuals who in reality were such cunning crooks that plain people, upon observing them, got spasms in the chest, as when one steps onto a cloud-piercing summit. As I began coming late, systematically late, as they called it, and missing work, or arriving in such condition that it was necessary to send me home, our relationship became unbearable. And finally, thanks to a joint effort, with the enthusiastic collaboration of the bookkeeper and of some stranger who had come in with a manuscript, I was thrown out. My poor, my pitiful youth. I vividly visualized the ghastly little room that I rented for $5 a month, the ghastly flowerets of the wallpaper, the ghastly lamp hanging from its cord, with a naked bulb, whose manic light glowed sometimes till morn. I was so miserable there, so indecently, luxuriously miserable, that the walls to this day must be saturated with misfortune and fever. And it is unthinkable that some happy chap could have lived there after me, whistling, humming. 10 years have elapsed, and even now I can still imagine myself then, a pale youth seated in front of the shimmery mirror with his livid forehead and black beard, dressed only in a torn shirt, guzzling cheap booze and clinking glasses with his reflection. What times those were! Not only was I of no use to anyone in the world, but I could not even imagine a set of circumstances in which someone might care a whit about me. By dint of prolonged, persistent, solitary drinking, I drove myself to the most vulgar of visions, the most Russian of all hallucinations. I began seeing devils. I saw them every evening, as soon as I emerged from my diurnal dreamery to dispel with my wretched lamp the twilight that was already engulfing us. Yes, even more clearly than I now see the perpetual tremor of my hand, I saw the precious intruders, and after some time, I even became accustomed to their presence, as they kept pretty much to themselves. They were smallish but rather plump, the size of an overweight toad, peaceful, limp, black-skinned, more or less warty little monsters. They crawled rather than walked, but, with all their feigned clumsiness, they proved uncapturable. I remember buying a dog whip, and, as soon as enough of them had gathered on my desk, I tried to give them a good lashing, but they miraculously avoided the blow. I struck again, and one of them, the nearest, only blinked, screwing up his eyes crookedly like a tense dog that someone wishes to threaten away from some tempting bit of ordure. The others dispersed, dragging their hind legs, but they all stealthily clustered together while I wiped up the ink spilled on the desk and picked up a prostrate portrait. Generally speaking, their densest habitat was the vicinity of my writing table. They materialized from somewhere underneath, and in leisurely fashion, their sticky bellies crepitating and smacking against the wood, made their way up the desk legs in a parody of climbing sailors. I tried smearing their route with Vaseline, but this did not help, and only when I happened to select some particularly appetizing little rotter, intently clambering upward, and swatted him with the whip or with my shoe, only then did he fall on the floor with a fat toad thud. But a minute later there he was again, on his way up from a different corner, his violet tongue hanging out from the strain, and once over the top he would join his comrades. They were numerous, and at first they all seemed alike to me, dark little creatures with puffy, basically rather good-natured faces. They sat in groups of five or six on the desk, on various papers, on a volume of Pushkin, glancing at me with indifference. One of them might scratch behind his ear with his foot, the long claw making a coarse scraping sound, and then freeze motionless, forgetting his leg in midair. Another would doze, uncomfortably crowding his neighbor, who, for that matter, was not blameless either. The reciprocal inconsiderateness of amphibians, capable of growing torpid in intricate attitudes. Gradually I began distinguishing them, and I think I even gave them names, depending on their resemblance to acquaintances of mine or to various animals. One could make out larger and smaller specimens, although they were all of quite portable size. Some were more repulsive, others more acceptable in aspect. Some had lumps or tumors, others were perfectly smooth. A few had a habit of spitting at each other. Once they brought a new boy, an albino, of a cinereous tint, with eyes like beads of red caviar. He was very sleepy and glum and gradually crawled away. With an effort of will, I would manage to vanquish the spell for a moment. It was an agonizing effort, for I had to repel and hold away a horrible iron weight, for which my entire being served as a magnet. I had but to loosen my grip, to give in ever so slightly, and the phantasma would take shape again, becoming precise, growing stereoscopic, and I would experience a deceptive sense of relief, the relief of despair, alas, when I once again yielded to the hallucination, and once again the clammy mass of thick-skinned clods sat before me on the desk, looking at me sleepily and yet somehow expectantly. I tried not only the whip, but also a famous time-honored method, on which I now find myself embarrassed to enlarge, especially since I must have used it in some wrong, very wrong way. Still, the first time it did work. A certain sacramental sign with bunched fingers pertaining to a particular religious cult was unhurriedly performed by me at a height of a few inches above the compact group of devils and grazed them like a red-hot iron with a succulent hiss, both pleasant and nasty. Whereupon, squirming from their burns, my rascals disparted and dropped with ripe plops to the floor. But when I repeated the experiment with a new gathering, the effect proved weaker, and after that they stopped reacting altogether. That is, they very quickly developed a certain immunity. But enough about that. With a laugh, what else did I have left? I would utter, "Foo!" The only expletive, by the way, borrowed by the Russian language from the lexicon of devils. See also the German Teufel. And without undressing, go to bed. On top of the covers, of course, as I was afraid of encountering unwanted bedfellows. Thus the days passed, if one can call them days. These were not days, but a timeless fog. And when I came to, I found myself rolling on the floor, grappling with my hefty landlord among the shambles of the furniture. With a desperate lunge, I freed myself and flew out of the room and thence onto the stairs, and the next thing I knew, I was walking down the street, trembling, disheveled, a vile bit of alien plaster sticking to my fingers, with an aching body and a ringing head, but almost totally sober. That was when L.I. took me under his wing. "What's the matter, old man?" We already knew each other slightly. He had been compiling a Russian-German pocket dictionary of technical terms and used to visit the office where I worked.
"Wait a minute, old man. Just look at yourself."
Right there on the corner. He was coming out of a delicatessen shop with his supper in his briefcase. I burst into tears. And without a word, L.I. took me to his place, installed me on the sofa, fed me liverwurst and beef tea, and spread over me a quilted overcoat with a worn Astrakhan collar. I shivered and sobbed and presently fell asleep. In short, I remained in his little apartment and lived like that for a couple of weeks, after which I rented a room next door, and we continued seeing each other daily. And yet, who would think we had anything in common? We were different in every respect. He was nearly twice my age, dependable, debonair, portly, dressed generally in a cutaway coat, cleanly and thriftily, like the majority of our orderly, elderly, emigre bachelors. It was worth seeing, and especially hearing, how methodically he brushed his trousers in the morning. The sound of that brushing is now so intimately associated with him, so prominent in my recollection of him, especially the rhythm of the process, the pauses between spells of scraping, when he would stop to examine a suspicious place, scratch at it with his fingernail, or hold it up to the light. Oh, those inexpressibles, as he called them, that let the sky's azure shine through at the knee. His inexpressibles, inexpressibly spiritualized by that ascension. His room was characterized by the naive neatness of poverty. He would imprint his address and telephone number on his letters with a rubber stamp. A rubber stamp. He knew how to make botvinya, a cold soup of beet tops. He was capable of demonstrating for hours on end some little trinket he considered a work of genius, a curious cufflink or cigarette lighter sold to him by a smooth-talking hawker. Note that L.I. himself did not smoke. Or his pets, three diminutive turtles with hideous crone-like necks. One of them perished in my presence when it crashed down from a round table along the edge of which it used to keep moving, like a hurrying cripple, under the impression that it was following a straight course, leading far, far away. Another thing that I just remembered with such clarity. On the wall above his bed, which was as smooth as a prisoner's cot, hung two lithographs, a view of the Neva from the Kolomna Rostrata side, and a portrait of Alexander I. He had happened to acquire them in a moment of yearning for the empire, a nostalgia he distinguished from the yearning for one's native land. L.I. totally lacked any sense of humor, and was totally indifferent to art, literature, and what is commonly known as nature. If the talk did happen to turn, say, to poetry, his contribution would be limited to a statement like, "No, say what you will, but Lermontov is somehow closer to us than Pushkin." And when I pestered him to quote even a single line of Lermontov, he made the obvious effort to recall something out of Rubinstein's opera, The Demon, or else answered, "Haven't reread him in a long while. All these are deeds of bygone days. And anyway, my dear Victor, just let me alone." Incidentally, he did not realize that he was quoting from Pushkin's Ruslan and Ludmila. In the summer, on Sundays, he would invariably go on a trip out of town. He knew the outskirts of Berlin in astonishing detail and prided himself on his knowledge of wonderful spots unfamiliar to others. This was a pure, self-sufficient delight, related perhaps to the delights of collectors, to the orgies indulged in by amateurs of old catalogues. Otherwise, it was incomprehensible why he needed it all, painstakingly preparing the route, juggling various means of transportation, there by train, then back to this point by steamer, thence by bus, and this is how much it costs, and nobody, not even the Germans themselves, knows it is so cheap. But when he and I finally stood in the woods, it turned out that he could not tell the difference between a bee and a bumblebee, or between alder and hazel, and perceived his surroundings quite conventionally and collectively. Greenery, fine weather. The feathered tribe, little bugs. He was even offended if I, who had grown up in the country, remarked, for the sake of a bit of fun, on the differences between the flora around us and a forest in central Russia. He felt that there existed no significant difference, and that sentimental associations alone mattered. He liked to stretch out on the grass in a shady spot, prop himself up on his right elbow, and discourse lengthily on the international situation, or tell stories about his brother Peter, apparently quite a dashing fellow, ladies' man, musician, brawler, who, back in prehistoric times, drowned one summer night in the Dnieper, a very glamorous end. In dear old L.I.'s account, though, it all turned out so dull, so thorough, so well rounded out, that when, during a rest in the woods, he would suddenly ask, with a kind smile,
"Did I ever tell you about the time Pete took a ride on the village priest's she-goat?"
I felt like crying out, "Yes, yes, you did. Please spare me." What would I not give to hear his uninteresting yarns now, to see his absent-minded, kindly eyes, that bald pate, rosy from the heat, those graying temples? What, then, was the secret of his charm, if everything about him was so dull? Why was everybody so fond of him? Why did they all cling to him? What did he do in order to be so well-liked? I don't know. I don't know the answer. I only know that I felt uneasy during his morning absences when he would leave for his Institute of Social Sciences, where he spent the time poring over bound volumes of Die Ökonomische Welt, from which he would copy in a neat, minute hand, excerpts that in his opinion were significant and noteworthy in the utmost, or for a private lesson of Russian, which he eternally taught to an elderly couple and the elderly couple's son-in-law, his association with them led him to make many incorrect conclusions about the German way of life, on which the members of our intelligentsia, the most unobservant race in the world, consider themselves authorities. Yes, I would feel uneasy, as though I had a premonition of what has since happened to him in Prague. Heart failure in the street. How happy he was, though, to get that job in Prague. How he beamed. I have an exceptionally clear recollection of the day we saw him off, Just think. A man gets the opportunity to lecture on his favorite subject. He left me a pile of old magazines. Nothing grows old and dusty as fast as a Soviet magazine. His shoe trees were destined to pursue me, and a brand new fountain pen as a memento. He showed great concern for me as he left, and I know that afterwards, when our correspondence somehow wilted and ceased, and life again crashed into deep darkness, a darkness howling with thousands of voices from which it is unlikely I will ever escape, L.I., I know, kept thinking about me, questioning people, and trying to help indirectly. He left on a beautiful summer day. Tears welled persistently in the eyes of some of those seeing him off. A myopic Jewish girl with white gloves and a lorgnette brought a whole sheaf of poppies and cornflowers. L.I. inexpertly sniffed them, smiling. Did it occur to me that I might be seeing him for the last time? Of course it did. That is exactly what occurred to me. Yes, I am seeing you for the last time. This, in fact, is what I always think about everything, about everyone. My life is a perpetual goodbye to objects and people that often do not pay the least attention to my bitter, brief, insane salutation.